I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Liberal Zionism is the tag phrase of the season on op-ed pages, in blogs, and campus conversation. J.J. Goldberg in the Jewish Forward says liberal Zionism is a stance supporting Israel, but not its policies. It's been an awkward straddle through this last lopsided war in Gaza, or whenever big principles are at stake, like equal rights and democracy for people subjected to apparently permanent occupation. This summer of 2014, something has snapped. Liberal Zionists in Israel, in Europe, in the U.S., keep coming forward declaring it's time to choose, and we can't be both. As Jonathan Friedland writes in the New York Review of Books, for example, and Anthony Lerman in the New York Times, does it help, looking forward, to remember the early Zionist vision of a Jewish homeland with room for Arabs as equals on what was their land, too? Unpeeling liberal Zionism. Starting with Peter Beinart, who framed the conversation this hour with his book, The Crisis of Zionism, 2 years ago. Jane Eisner, editor of the Jewish Daily Forward, the weekly newspaper, will join us. Also, Philip Weiss, the contrarian blogger at mondoweiss.net, covering the war of ideas in the Middle East, as he puts it. And Bernard Avishai, prolific analyst and author who blogs at The New Yorker online and The Daily Beast and his own site. Peter Beinart, get us started. Set us at your sort of crossroads. And is it different after this Gaza summer? Welcome.
Thank you. Look, Israel was founded to do two different things that are in tension. One was to give the Jewish people, in the wake of the Holocaust, one country in the world that would have the protection of Jewish life as its mission statement, that would privilege the protection of Jewish life in Israel and around the world, in a world that after the Holocaust seemed to have been very indifferent to it. On the other hand, Israel was also founded to be a democracy, and of course not all of the people inside Israel, even inside Israel's original boundaries, before Israel took the West Bank and Gaza Strip, were Jewish. 20% of Israel's own citizens are Palestinian. So Israel's Declaration of Independence talked about a state with a Jewish character that would also provide, quote, complete equality of social and political rights, irrespective of race, religion, and sex. Now, there is a deep tension between those two imperatives, a state that wants to give representation and protection for one particular religious and ethnic group, and also wants to try to provide equality for all of its citizens. Some might argue that the tension is insoluble. I would argue that there can be legitimate imperatives that are in tension, that economic development and environmental protection, for instance, are often in tension, and yet we wouldn't say that one of them is necessarily illegitimate because it's in tension with the other. For me, the tragedy is that since 1967, instead of Israel moving towards trying to minimize that tension, to find better ways to give greater equality to the Palestinians who live inside Israel while also maintaining that role as the refuge of last resort for Jews around the world, the tension has grown greater. The discrepancy has grown deeper, fundamentally because Israel in 1967 took control of territories, the West Bank and Gaza, where it took control of the lives of millions of Palestinians to whom it did not give citizenship at all. So while Israel had this original population of Palestinian citizens of Israel, who are often called Arab Israelis, who it was not giving full equality to, but who at least were citizens, lived under the same law, and had the right to vote, Israel massively compounded the difficulty of reconciling democracy and Zionism, or liberalism and Zionism, when it took control of millions of Palestinians to whom it did not give citizenship, did not give the right to vote, put under a different legal system than the Jews who moved into the West Bank.
Peter Bernard, I just want to...
is the danger.
Okay. You write in your book... about feeling these tensions, this conflict in your own heart and your family history. I mean, give us the short form here, starting with your grandmother, or was it great-grandmother?
My grandmother, I say in my book that my grandmother made me a Zionist. I felt that through her, I was in touch with some of the fragility of 20th century Jewish life. My grandmother was born in Egypt, a community that has a country that has virtually no Jews anymore. Then the community moved to the Belgian Congo, which also has virtually no Jews. Originally, they were traced their ancestry to the Isle of Rhodes, a community destroyed in the Holocaust,
and even Spain before that,
Spain,
yeah.
destroyed in the Inquisition. So I saw for my grandmother, who had a brother who had moved to Israel, the way in which the existence of a Jewish state, even though she never went to live there herself, was a source of security and comfort for her, a sense that there was one place where Jewish bags were not always packed. And while that may seem remote from the experience of younger Jews in the United States today, I also remember myself in the 1980s when Israel sent airplanes to pick up the Jews of Ethiopia, one of the poorest and most reviled communities on earth. No other country in the world was going to stick its neck out to save those people. And they were saved because they were Jews, and they were returned to be with the people from whom they had been estranged since the days when the temple stood. And for me, that was a formative experience in my own Zionism.
How did this third Gaza war test your faith, Peter Barnett? And what has it done to the conversation, in your view?
It's made it even more deeply polarized. You know, I think on the one hand, I had an emotional reaction, like many Jews did, seeing Israel under fire. I actually happened to be in Israel for the first week of the war with my six-year-old daughter. We were in and out of shelters, and wanting to be in solidarity with Jews who were afraid and who were suffering and who were scared. On the other hand, I felt myself deeply torn between that instinct and a different feeling, which is that this war was not necessary, that all of the terrible, terrible, brutal destruction that destroyed so many lives in Gaza was not necessary, that it was the result of an Israeli government that had not acted creatively and courageously in trying to get towards a two-state solution.
And not quite honestly even about the provocation of the war, you've written, you said.
Right. I mean, to me, the most important thing that I think we have to face about Hamas is that if you want to defeat Hamas politically, you have to show Palestinians that when they use nonviolence and when they support the two-state solution, that they get somewhere. And this Israeli government has destroyed those Palestinians who believe in nonviolence and the two-state solution. All you have to do is read what Salam Fayyad said. He was Israel's favorite Palestinian politician, and when he left politics, he said, Israel destroyed me with the continued settlement building that destroyed my nonviolent two-state enterprise. And to me, that was the context which made the Gaza war so tragic and made it impossible for me to wholeheartedly get behind and support Israel's behavior, even though many people I knew were very, very, in my community, were very, very unhappy with me as a result.
Peter Barnett, I wonder, for you, watching an awful tragedy unfolding in Gaza and thinking of a crisis in Zionism, in your title, how different is all that from, say, speaking of a crisis in Americanism, or being an American peacenik who's appalled by our wars abroad ever since Vietnam? What's the difference in the nature of the crisis and the political difference?
Well, it's a good question. On the one hand, look, anyone who is critical of their government's policies in wartime risks a feeling of kind of national excommunication, the sense that in a time when people value solidarity above all else because they're in pain and they're enraged, that there's a sense that you exile yourself if you will not stand with the rest of your countrymen, or in this case, if you're Jewish, with your people, even though it's a transnational people. And so I think Americans who were, you know, who opposed American policy during Vietnam or in the aftermath of 9/11 have a lot in common with Israelis or you know, those Jews in the diaspora who criticize Israel during time of war. I happen to think that it's precisely during wartime that voices of criticism are most necessary, because that's when the most people are getting hurt. The difference is that Israel and the United States are not the same. Israel is a different kind of democracy. It is a democracy inside the green lines, but it's an ethnic democracy. In that case, it's actually more similar to some of the democracies in Europe, which is to say it has a special obligation to a certain religious and ethnic group. That's not the case in the United States. And that means there is a tension between the promise of equality and the promise of Israeli national identity in a way that is different than in the United States. And I believe in trying to deal with the tension, because I believe in the idea of a certain kind of Jewish state. Not any Jewish state, for goodness knows, but a certain kind of Jewish state. But in Israel, it's more difficult because the United States has no particular sense of responsibility to any one religious or ethnic group. Certainly not, maybe you could argue it did in the 19th century when, of course, blacks were slaves. But today, under law, the United States doesn't.
Stick with the American analog here. You've proposed a response for Jews, American Jews, but also Israelis, sort of out of American history. You've spoken about a protest inside the West Bank after the example of Robert Moses's Freedom Summer in Mississippi in 1964. Talk about it. What's the prospect? No, is it a plausible strategy?
Right. What Robert Moses saw was that blacks in Mississippi were doing their own protest, but they wasn't getting national attention. His idea was that if you brought white college kids from across the country, and that would bring the cameras, and then the country would have to focus on the brutality of African American life in Mississippi. This was my idea for what we need in the West Bank. There is, although you don't always hear about it much in the press, has been a lot of nonviolent protest in various parts of the West Bank against because of dispossession and the lack of basic rights of Palestinians. And yet it doesn't get through often in the American media. It certainly doesn't get through to the American Jewish community. But if we were able to have hundreds or even thousands of American Jews, especially young American Jews, who were to go to participate nonviolently in support of Palestinians who only want the same basic rights that we want, and they could also do it, I certainly would, in the name of a democratic Palestine alongside a democratic Israel, their parents would have to pay attention. The American Jewish community would have to pay attention. I think the media would pay attention. And like Freedom Summer, there would be more of a focus on what I think is in many ways the core issue, which is the 47-year lack of basic rights. Palestinians in the West Bank live without a passport, without the right to vote for the government that controls their lives, under a different legal system than their Jewish neighbors. I'm not claiming that there are not important differences between the situation for African Americans and the situation for Palestinians, but there is a basic injustice, and I was thinking about a way to call attention to it in a nonviolent way.
It would be wonderful to hope it is a plausible strategy. We'll come back to it. Coming up, Philip Weiss of Mondo Weiss and Bernard Avishai of a visionary book, The Hebrew Republic. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Liberal Zionism is the twinned idea that we're parsing. Jane Eisner edits the foreword, a main voice of Jewish Americanism since 1897, a workers' paper, socialist at the beginning, a paper that was strong for FDR and the New Deal, strong for Israel as well. Jane Eisner, what does the foreword readership say, and what does the editor think about the so-called crisis?
Well, I think that Peter explained very eloquently the issue here. I, in my more hopeful moments, don't think it's quite as dire. I found myself emerging from this very difficult summer holding two contrary things in my heart. And the older I get, the more I find that that happens a lot in life. And one of them was that I really did think that Israel had the right to defend itself against years of uncalled for rocket attacks. And I think once we learned about the tunnels, particularly that really, I think, highlighted the serious threat to the country by Hamas in Gaza. At the same time, I'm a human being. I could not be anything but utterly sad and dispirited and grieving for all the loss of life, the loss of property, the loss of hope in a whole generation of Gazans. And both of those things are very real to me. And I think that it's important for Jews here to acknowledge both of those facts, even though they are maybe strategically at odds with each other. I think that they both really happened.
What is your readership feedback to you, Jane?
Well, we've been writing a lot about this issue. I've written about it. Our columnist J.J. Goldberg has. We've had some
whom I so admire
guest columnists as well. And I think there's a general feeling of sort of a kind of malaise, a depression after this summer, a feeling that we don't know where to put our hopes next. However, I still think that most Jews are liberal. Certainly most American Jews are liberal. And we see that expressed over and over again, not just on Election Day, but in so many ways. I was very involved with the Pew Research Center study that was released last fall, and we saw that liberalism emerge in many different ways, not just in party identification.
Now, just say, though, you were in Israel this summer, especially, and you wrote about being among settlers on the West Bank, not the kind of Israel I want, you wrote.
Mm-hmm.
A place in constant conflict.
I have to say that I go to Israel at least once a year and try to really get out and report a lot when I'm there. And this trip in June, which was after the yeshiva boys were kidnapped but before their bodies were announced to have been found, and so therefore before the hostilities really started, it was a very strange time to be there. Mm-hmm. I spent a lot of time in the West Bank because I wanted to really listen to settlers and understand what was going on with them, trying to see if they really were the impediment to peace that we have, at least I have thought. And I did find it very dispiriting. Mm-hmm. And I did emerge from that wondering what was going to happen. And that was before the war began. And so, yeah, I mean, I feel even less hopeful, but that doesn't mean that I'm abandoning hope either.
Jane Eisner, stand by. Philip Weiss is an American writer of fiction and journalism. He broke into blogging 7 years ago precisely to vent his own experience of Jewishness and his own rude views on Israel, among other things. Philip Weiss, welcome to Open Source. You told me in a podcast 2 years ago that you wanted a family fight among American Jews around Zionism. Do you still, or how is the fight going?
I guess I'm very pleased by the aftermath of Gaza, this latest onslaught, in that I think that the Jewish community is beginning to fully engage the question of the meaning of Zionism. And the American Jewish community is beginning to engage this question. And
what is the question?
I think the question is essentially this movement in Jewish life that was so meaningful to Peter's grandmother because it spoke to Jewish conditions in Europe. And I guess she wasn't only in Europe, but this movement, what meaning does it have to Jews now, to young Jews, to people who are trying to plan their lives and create the future? And I would say that the tension in Zionism is now resolved. Any tension that it is essentially a movement that privileges one people over another, and therefore is going to foster violent resistance to it from the millions of Palestinians who exist in under its control. And so the violence we've seen this summer is predictable. It's part of a resistance movement, and the Israeli response is completely unimaginative. It's simply an effort to mow the lawn. And what I'm saying about this cycle is that this is now very visible to young American Jews who don't face the exigencies that Peter's grandmother faced. And I think that they will come to this conversation is beginning to happen inside the Jewish community in a very active way.
How does it go? I mean, what is the contrary line, that we simply don't need it, that there will never be a crisis of a Jewish minority again? How does it go?
I don't think that anyone who's serious could assert that there'll never be a Jewish crisis again, given Jewish history. I mean, we are a minority, and we've been subject to persecution again and again. I think that, I guess in a nutshell, I would say that this is an ideology, a movement, a political understanding that originated as a political understanding during the Dreyfus trial, when Herzl was hearing people shouting death to the Jews in the streets of Paris. And it's resolved itself 120 years later with Jews in the streets of Jerusalem saying death to the Arabs. And that is really the alpha and omega of Zionism. It achieved its goals. It created a state, and that state has, despite the best efforts of these wonderful liberals who've been engaged on this and who see this tension between democracy and a Jewish state, but think it can somehow be resolved. Despite these efforts, there it's a fantasy. It has been resolved. It is a Jewish state, and it's one that privileges one group over another, and therefore it will be forever riven by these questions of racism that plagued the Jim Crow South. And so I think that young Jews, what I think is so great about this horrors that occurred this summer is that we're beginning to see this conversation full on among young Jews, and they're bringing this argument into the shuls, they're bringing it into the streets, and it's going to be a crisis, not of Zionism, but for the Jewish community.
I don't hear the argument so much as the sort of tuning out, Phil. I mean, this is not my fight. It's not our generation. Let's do something else. But would you just stand by? I want to introduce Bernard Abishai, born in Montreal. He's an American writer who teaches now at Dartmouth College and at the Hebrew University. He lives half the year in Jerusalem, half in New Hampshire. He wrote The Tragedy of Zionism in 1985, The Hebrew Republic in 2008. Bernie Abishai, you went to Israel as a young man 40 years ago in the expansive, triumphal moment after the Six-Day War. When you go back to Israel today and the plane hits 30,000 feet, what are you thinking? What are you feeling? Why are you going back?
Well, the first thing I'm feeling, which no one yet has talked about, is that I've got to switch from English to Hebrew. And the part of my brain that has to become engaged is the part that becomes engaged with the Hebrew culture, which was actually the real reason for Zionism in the first place. I mean, I think there's something missing from this conversation, which seems to make the state of Israel provisional upon the loyalties of American Jewish kids. Like, you know, well, if they get turned off, then, well, maybe we should start over. That thing wasn't probably a good idea to have in the first place.
Would you say that, Phil, or not? Let's start over, or I don't know. No,
well,
continue,
look,
ready. When Phil Weiss says we've seen the Alpha and the Omega of Zionism.
Yeah, I think that's a cartoon. The Alpha, Zionism doesn't have an Alpha and Omega. Zionism was a movement that was in many ways much more radical and less potentially fancy than what's being discussed here. It was an effort to create a modernist way of being Jewish. That is to say, take a religious community, a reviled religious community, turn it into a national community, which does not necessarily mean privileging an ethnic group or a religion. In fact, most of the rabbis hated most of the Zionists because what the Zionists were saying is, no, we've got to find a way of being Jewish in the modern world, which means that we have to create a language of our own, a culture of our own. And when I land in Israel, the first thing that strikes me is how vibrant that Hebrew culture is. Now that country exists and it has a politics. And in that politics are liberals and conservatives, reactionaries and fascists and socialists. There are all kinds of people in the spectrum. People who are liberals, such as myself, in Israel are on the defensive right now. And we have a leadership which is pretty awful and has done some pretty awful things. That's also true, by the way, when I'm here in America and George Bush is president, by the way. So we have a country. We have a country with a politics. We have a country with national distinction because Zionism actually succeeded many years ago. And I'm not even sure why we keep debating whether Zionism has an Alpha Omega or anything else. Zionism succeeded in creating this country 60 plus years ago.
Remind me, why did you call it a tragedy?
I called it a tragedy when I wrote The Tragedy of Zionism back in 1985 because I saw a lot of the things that Peter so eloquently described. But the key problem was that the democratic state which Israel had undertaken to create was being weighed down by certain residual Zionist institutions that were then focused on settling the West Bank and creating the settler community that has blown back on Israeli democracy and has been a fetter on Israeli democracy. And it's very important for Israeli liberals to complete Israeli democracy, to get Israeli democracy up to code. And it's very hard to do that within the context of an occupation. So
that diagnosis was 30 years ago. What's the trend and where is it going? What's the way out?
Well, I think
it depends.
It depends what administration you're talking about. There was a, you know, it trended differently when Rabin was prime minister. Then when he was assassinated by some of the people who are now very sympathetic to the people in power, it trended differently. Then it trended back when Ehud Olmert was prime minister into a peace and democratic effort. And then it trended back when Netanyahu became prime minister. And the idea that somehow the last atrocity defines the DNA of a country seems to me so absurd as to be really beneath our dignity here.
Is that what you were saying, Philip?
I think that, yeah, it is what I'm saying. Bernie's talking about something different from, he's not addressing the political question here, which is a fundamental, foundational political issue that exists in Israel and Palestine, and that Peter does address, is the fact that you have a country that is governed by a ruling coalition, a coalition of Jewish parties and Jewish politicians that is governing 4 to 5 million Palestinian people, many of whom don't have the right to vote. That's a profound political foundational problem. And the rebirth of Hebrew culture is a wonderful thing. I, as Bernie knows, I don't fully appreciate it. I don't speak Hebrew. Great. I'm glad it's flourishing. But the question that Noam Shazoff, a young Israeli journalist, and that Gideon Levy, an old Israeli journalist, the question they frame to Bernie would be, well, okay, fine, you know, it requires change, and you want to preserve it. Why not extend the vote to these Palestinians right now over the to consent to the government that controls their lives.
Well, Bernie Abishai, and then Jane, I know you want to get in.
Well, first of all, there's something of a caricature here because 20% of the Israeli population is Arab, and it does vote. So we're talking now about the people who are living in the West Bank who don't. This occupation's been going on a long time. It's got to end. No one has been more vocal about that than myself. Moreover.
One question.
No, just let me finish. Moreover, I think that Israel, in pursuing the two-state solution, is ultimately going to have to come up to some kind of federal idea with the Palestinians in the West Bank. I've been writing that for 25 years. So I have no problem with thinking creatively about the Israeli state apparatus in order to create a political structure that will give each side its national distinction on the one hand and some full degree of political rights on the other. That seems to me not that complicated. They did it in Quebec and Ontario. They did it elsewhere. We can do that in Israel and Palestine.
Jane Eisner of The Forward, it's your turn.
It just seems that much of this conversation is forgetting that, yes, this occupation is terrible. It is ruining Israel's soul, but Israel is not only responsible for it. It has only been recently that the Palestinians have had leadership that acknowledges Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state in whatever borders it is. And of course, we still have many Palestinians ruled by people like Hamas who do not even recognize Israel's right to exist. So I think that it is, in a sense, almost infantilizing the Palestinians to say that they don't have some agency in this.
Well, they had no agency in the dedication of 1,000 acres after the Gaza War to Israeli settlements. I mean, the initiative comes from Israel, does it not?
Yes, that is absolutely wrong. But we also have had decades of Palestinian leaders refusing to recognize Israel and to make peace with Israel. I mean, I'm not excusing the Israelis by saying that, but we also have to acknowledge that they are not the only parties to this. And it's not simply a matter of just saying we either grant the vote or we just leave. I mean, there is a security issue. Israel has suffered terrible, terrible terrorism inside Israel, not just in occupied territories. And so I think that we really have to recognize that much of the struggle of this very young country. I mean, my goodness, you know, this is in America. We had to have a civil war to just even begin to deal with the fact that we privileged a whole set of people over others. And as we know, it took 100 more years legally for that to change, and it still hasn't finally changed here as well. And Israel is still a very, very young country, and it has made a lot of tremendous mistakes, but it is not alone responsible for the situation now.
Jane Eisner, Bernard Avishai, Peter Beinart. We're going to take a stab at liberal Zionism 3.0. Let's talk about truth, but also about reconciliation, an exit strategy out of a genuine nightmare. Starting with the Israeli novelist David Grossman, maybe the model of a conscience on the edge. When I interviewed David Grossman at length 3 years ago on his epic To the End of the Land, it was his view that Israelis and Palestinians, both maybe equally, are so damaged now by history and hatred as to require strong intervention from outside, no matter how they resist it.
All my writing, both fiction and nonfiction, is about how an individual can change his situation in every given predicament. You know, that you always can do something to improve or to find other nuances of the situation, and by so doing, to liberate yourself from it. You know, I'll give you a banal example. I think of someone who was in extermination camp and gave half of a slice of his bread to a friend or to someone that was next to him. Maybe he died a day later, but by giving this slice of bread, in a way, he has uprooted himself from the situation. He changed the whole situation for a moment. He was not a victim anymore. What freaks me out is that Israel, who was meant to be the homeland of the Jewish people and a place where we shall never again be victims, never again be dependent on the goodwill or the bad will of others. And look at us now. The largest superpower in the region, so many options, so much talents and abilities, and yet we are trapped, we are victims of the situation, of our own fears, unable to separate between the real dangers and the echoes of past traumas that also paralyze us. We are victims to the mistakes and crimes of the Palestinians in their war against us. We are victims to this belief that nothing can be changed. I think that for a Jew, Israel is the most significant place to be today. It is the most relevant place. It is the place where we formulate our life in Hebrew. And still, you know, with all the problems and troubles, Israel is an idea that is worth fighting for. This idea could be achieved and become reality only when peace is achieved. Only then we shall be able to have it.
That was the Israeli novelist David Grossman in conversation with me 3 years ago. He is embattled again this summer in protests against the Netanyahu government and the war in Gaza. But he gets us to visions of the future for liberals and Israelis. Peter Beinart, do you have a vision? What's your way out? Way forward.
I think that David Grossman is a hero of mine. To be honest, part of why I write about this subject here and try in a small way to try to change the American Jewish community is because I want to be in solidarity with people like him. I want to try to help people like him. That's my Zionism, is a transatlantic bond between Jews who believe in our right to self-protection, but also who believe, and I think this is the most profound point that David Grossman was making, that we are not only victims anymore, that we have power, and that the entire Jewish tradition is at stake in what happens when Jews wield power, that our tradition for thousands of years of exile was formed when we did not have power. We thought of the most extraordinary ethical ideas that lit up the entire world, and yet they were not really tested because we didn't have power over others. What I find most fundamentally fascinating and important about the project of Zionism and Israeli statehood is that it is the ultimate post facto test of our entire tradition, of whether our tradition of justice and equality can have meaning, not just when we're powerless, because after all, when you're powerless, you can think whatever you want about what you would do to others under your dominion. It's now that it's being tested. It's the feeling that Israel is failing that test that haunts me most deeply, and I feel like the way for American Jews to begin to move beyond the language that we are imprisoned in is for us to reconnect to those elements of our tradition which talk about the ethical responsibilities of power. We again and again only look at our tradition as stories of victimhood and survival. We need to think about what happens after survival and think about what our tradition can teach us about the ethical responsibilities of Jewish power, because that's what's at play in Israel today.
Stand by, Peter Barnett. Philip Weiss, I wish you'd apply your own sense of the tradition and your own Jewishness to the question of the future.
I would say, my sense of my Jewish identity is really formed by the Mississippi Freedom Summer, by the Freedom Riders, by the Civil Rights Movement, in which Jews played such a prominent role, and therefore, in this case, in which we're looking at a situation of Jim Crow and worse, of apartheid, there's just no question in my mind that Jews have to engage, American Jews have to engage on the side of the oppressed, and those are the Palestinians. But within Jewish life, I think this is a wonderful moment because it is, as Peter says, a test. It's a test of values, and we're being asked to consider how this Zionist project, which was born out of the worst Jewish historical experience in Europe, we're being asked to say how has it turned out and does it match up to our values, and it doesn't. It simply fails. It absolutely fails that test. And I would say that even Bernie's example of 20% of the population of Israel that can vote that's Palestinian, they're never represented in the governing coalition. So it's very much like the 1964 Mississippi Freedom Democrats that Jews supported, the people who said, we want to be delegates to the nominating process so that we can help choose the president of our country. And that doesn't happen in Israel. So there are just countless ways in which the sort of liberal American tradition that I'm part of is failing over there. And it is a crisis. I think that just to echo what Jane says, there is Palestinian agency there. And what Jews have to understand here is the Palestinians will not accept Zionism. They don't want Zionism. You can't make them a party to Zionism. And therefore, a creative solution has to involve honoring those people's political responses to the regime under which they exist.
Could I just observe from the sidelines, so to speak, but early Zionism, long before Hitler, long before Israel, overflows with a certain cosmopolitan, democratic, peaceful vision. In Theodor Herzl's novel, which I've only read in part, the novel Altneuland.
It's unreadable.
Well, I'm just snippets for me, but the hero who becomes the head of the nation says, we must hold fast to the things that have made us great, to liberality, tolerance, and love of mankind. Only then is Zion truly Zion. And he says, let the stranger be at home among
right.
us. And then the great...
in his diaries. He says, the test of our state will be whether how we treat the stranger. It has failed Herzl's test completely and utterly.
Let me just throw in also, but in terms of the vision, one sec, Jane. The great founding philosopher Ahad Ha'am said that the Arabs in Palestine had earned their right to the land and their own national dream. He said that made Palestine a common possession of different peoples. So just to say that liberal caste of Zionism is rooted in its history. But I would ask, as a practical matter going forward, is it not the only way? Is it not the only hope?
I don't know.
Bernie Avishai.
Rodney.
I would just like, for the record, to dispute some of what Philip said. I think that it is inaccurate to say that there is no Palestinian political representation in the government. There have been Arab Israelis sitting on the Supreme Court. There have been Arab Israelis in leadership positions in the Knesset. You're right that those parties have not been part of the governing coalition, but I think it is just not right to say that they are entirely excluded from political life.
He didn't say that. He said they don't have agency, Jane, I think.
No, I'm sorry. Philip said that they have absolutely no political voice, and I don't think that is accurate at all. It is not a perfect democracy by any stretch of the imagination. It has much to improve upon. I have spent time in the last few years in some Arab states where the democracy is even much less perfect. And so I think, you know, Israel's operating in a very, very tough region, and we expect Israel to be better than
but come back to the,
all
that,
its neighbors.
That...
And it should be, but I think that we have to also acknowledge that there is a lot of ways in which there is a flourishing Arab-Israeli life in politics, economics, and education, and in other ways in Israel, even if it does not meet our ideals, and it doesn't. I agree. But
it is not... Israel is not anything like a common possession of different peoples, as Ahad Ha'am said. I'm thinking...
Well, just a moment, Chris. It's not the common possession of different peoples. It is a people, that is to say, it is a nation. It has a culture that is rooted in Hebrew. This is the state of Israel, not the state of Ishmael. There is clearly going to be some privilege for Hebrew culture in Israel, and the Arabs will be a minority. In some sense, I'm sympathetic to Phil's concern that within Israel there are residual problems of Israeli democracy which structurally discriminate against non-Jews. That's a problem. That has to be changed. It can be changed within the rubric of Israel and within the rubric of Hebrew culture. The thing that I want to come back to and I'm a little concerned about is this idea that Israel's a test of somehow Jewish civilization. I mean, Jewish civilization wasn't all about, you know, Rabbi Heschel. It wasn't all about people marching in Selma. Jewish civilization is full of people who had a concern for freedom, people who had a, you know, terribly bigoted, reactionary types. It was full of human beings. The worst thing you can say about Israel and the worst thing you can say about Jews is that they're human. And we have all kinds of people.
But more so, as Edna Ferber used to say.
Well, you know, Rodney Dangerfield, I don't know if he's Jewish, actually, but Rodney Dangerfield had this great line when he heard Frank Sinatra sing it, "I Did It My Way." He said, "I did it my way. I didn't know there were that many ways to do it." You know, Israel doesn't have to actually invent something special here. Liberal life is pretty well established by now in the minds of people in the West. Most Israelis, they may not have read John Stuart Mill cover to cover, but they kind of get it, you know, and they didn't necessarily find that liberalism in Judaism. They didn't find it in Jewish values. They are Hebrew-speaking people who are attuned to the legacies of Jewish civilization, and they have among them liberals who are fighting for liberal democracy, just like the Greeks have Greeks fighting for liberal democracy.
Come back to my question, though, about what David Grossman was speaking about, an open, fraternal reconciliation of two terribly damaged peoples. Yeah, I.F. Stone called it, and it was reprinted in Harper's Magazine in a very beautiful page. He called it the other Zionism, but the Zionism of the real founding visionaries.
I'm completely with that, and I think that in some sense, going back to Herzl, underestimates the problem. I think that, you know, Ahad Ha'am and the other Zionists who thought of building this liberal democracy were really interested in individual conscience in a very profound way.
Give Philip Weiss a chance and then Peter Beinart, please. Philip Weiss, respond. What about that other reconciled Zionism?
I think that the thing that I find that's a little illusory about this conversation is that we're just emerging from what I regard as a massacre, what others have called a genocide, and that for which there wasn't really a good reason. And the problem with Israeli society is that there are going to be more wars like this because of this profound political foundational issue. We're dealing with one of the great intractable political problems of the world, and one that the history of the world or the last 200 years suggests could end very badly, like the Civil War or like Algeria. And those are the models for me, not good models. And that's why I think this is a matter of enormous urgency. The compromises that were available to both in the two-state solution, that compromise, I think, is over. Just as the Missouri Compromise vanished in the 1850s in America. And that's what we're looking at. We're looking at a terrible bloodletting ultimately here that would resolve these incompatible claims.
Peter Beinart, what would get us out of it? What would avert it, steer us around it?
I think that the best hope is moral pressure on Israel. And Israeli policy that strengthens the hands of those Palestinians who are willing to live in peace, who are willing to oppose violence, and who can accept the idea of two states. I agree with Jane that Palestinians have agency. I agree that Palestinians have made terrible mistakes and committed crimes. But I think what's not well understood enough in the American Jewish discourse often is that in the divide among Palestinians between Hamas and others who can accept Israel's right to exist. They may not be happy about it. No Palestinians are happy about it. But who can accept the idea of two states, two nationalisms, two peoples with their own flag and their own special countries that represent their national identities, that Israel has a vote in that struggle, and that it is critically important that Israel act, because it is the most powerful party, act in a way to strengthen those Palestinians who can live alongside it and who believe in the idea of nonviolence.
Peter, let me ask you, Jane, Bernie, Philip, what about David Grossman's plea for intervention? Rescue us. We can't do it. These are wounded, battered, maimed survivors, and they're not up to it.
I completely agree. These two peoples have... it's not just the two peoples. Each people has a politics, and each people has a minority, which is polarizing the situation for the majority. And you need outside intervention to keep the radical, rejectionist, recalcitrant minorities in each people. We need outside intervention to bring together the majorities that want reconciliation and keep the minorities from pulling them apart.
Last word from you, Philip, on the matter of intervention, rescue, quickly.
I wanted to hear what Jane had to say about that.
Jane, it's your turn then.
Only just to add one word. I think that outside intervention also has to be humble. I mean, we're not living there. We're not thinking in Hebrew or in Arabic all the time. And so I think we have an obligation as Jews to care about other people, to care about the stranger, Jews, Palestinians, or whomever. And I think I agree with everything that Peter said in terms of the necessity for us to do what is appropriate. But I personally feel a certain degree of humility. I didn't lose the son the way David Grossman did. And so to me, I want to take my cues from people who are there and who have devoted their lives to this struggle.
Jane Eisner, let's keep talking, but our time is up. Thank you, Peter Beinart, Jane Eisner, Philip Weiss, Bernard Avishai. Our show was produced by Max Larkin with help from Will Freeman and Maria Jose Fabre. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Leiden. Join us next time on Open Source.